It's Wednesday, December 27th here in Asia, and Tuesday the 26th here in Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up... another giant of the entertainment world leaves us in 2016. This time it's an actress known around the world simply as Princess Leia. Carrie Fisher of Star Wars fame dies at the age of 60. China scores a diplomatic win over Taiwan. We'll have reaction. We'll hear the latest from Moscow on an investigation into the crash of a Russian military plane. And we'll find out if robot truckers will take the jobs of human drivers. It's all ahead on International Edition. The family of American actress Carrie Fisher says she died Tuesday morning at a Los Angeles hospital where she was taken for treatment after suffering a heart attack on Friday while on a flight from the city of London. Fisher, who was 60 years old, had been in critical condition and on life support in the last few days. She's best known around the world for this role that she first played in 1977's Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, Princess Leia, an agent of a rebel alliance trying to stop Darth Vader from using an evil empire's cataclysmic weapon, the Death Star.
I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. My father will know how to retrieve it. You must see this droid safely delivered to him on Alderaan. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Well, Fisher reprised that role in Star Wars Episodes 5 and 6, and then once again in Episode 7, The Force Awakens, which came out a year ago. She also had other memorable movie roles. Earlier I spoke with American film critic and historian Leonard Maltin and asked him whether Star Wars overshadowed her other cinematic appearances.
Well, I think you could say that Star Wars and the role of Princess Leia overshadowed everything Carrie Fisher did the rest of her life. You know, she's been busy as a writer, as a performer, as a participant in documentaries, as a novelist, but all people really know her for and care about is that she played Princess Leia.
Right. Do you think people should care, though, about some of the other movies that she did actually act in and that got some critical acclaim?
Well, she's in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters. She's in When Harry Met Sally. She's in some pretty memorable and prominent films. So that shouldn't be forgotten. She's in a great episode of 30 Rock with Tina Fey playing herself. And she was a talent. There's a reason George Lucas cast her. She was good.
How did Carrie Fisher get to be so good? Because she acted in the first Star Wars movie at the age of 19. So what was her path to get to that point?
Well, she grew up in show business. She grew up prominently in show business. Her mother was and is Debbie Reynolds, a big star, a versatile star who could sing, dance, act, the whole works. And her father was a very popular singer, Eddie Fisher. So she grew up in and around show business. It was in her blood.
Why do you think Carrie Fisher, later in her career, did more work behind the scenes than in front of the camera?
I think she came to feel a certain reluctance to appear on screen. She became very self-conscious about her looks. She gained some weight. She got a little older. People were unkind in commenting about that. She was aware of that. And I think that was a source of some hurtfulness to her. But she never stopped writing. In addition to writing novels and a recent memoir, she was known as a script doctor. Directors would bring screenplays to her to add humor, to add love interest, and she became one of the most reliable script doctors in town.
I actually read that she wasn't really credited on screen for some of those script doctoring roles.
No,
how unusual is that?
That's typical. It's very typical. Very, very big names sometimes contribute this way to films doing a final polish or a final draft. They get a lot of money, but no credit.
Well, you know, Carrie Fisher obviously had a very eventful personal life in terms of her relationships, her struggles with drug addiction. But what's interesting to me is that she remained fairly well-loved here in the U.S. and beyond in spite of that. Why do you think she was able to remain such a popular figure in popular culture?
Well, she made the jokes before anyone else could. She beat them to the punch, or beat them to the punchline, you could say. She did a one-woman show called Wishful Drinking about her problems with alcohol and with abuse, and about her turbulent life growing up in the spotlight, daughter of celebrities, headline-making celebrities. So, as I say, she kind of undercut anybody's ability to use her as fodder. She used her own life as fodder.
Seems like a
good
strategy.
And she wrote a memoir called Postcards from the Edge in the form of a novel, but it's pretty autobiographical, and wrote the screenplay for that. So she took full credit for herself.
Well, she does have one other film that's yet to come out, that's Star Wars Episode VIII. What do we know about her role in that final movie and what this means for the future of the franchise?
Not a thing. I know, not a thing. But remember that in Rogue One, they brought an actor back to life who's been dead for 20 years. So who knows what will happen in the future.
And just lastly, what would you say is your favorite memory of Carrie Fisher?
I think her self-deprecating sense of humor.
Okay. Well, thank you so much to Leonard Maltin, film critic and historian, for speaking to VOA's International Edition.
You're welcome.
Well, it's time for a look at social media, and I'm joined in the studio by David Byrd. David, how would you say Hollywood is reacting to the passing of Carrie Fisher?
Well, it's universally sad. The reaction has been no words, actually, was what Mark Hamill, her co-star from Star Wars, who played Luke Skywalker, put on his Twitter feed. He said, no words, hashtag devastated. Harrison Ford, who played Han Solo in the Star Wars movie, said Carrie was one of a kind, brilliant and original, funny and emotionally fearless. She lived her life bravely, and we will all miss her. Peter Mayhew, who fans might not know his name, but they certainly know his character, Chewbacca.
Oh, Chewbacca.
Said, there are no words for this loss. Carrie was the brightest light in every room she entered. I will miss her dearly. Billy Dee Williams, who played Lando Calrissian in the Star Wars movies, said, I'm deeply saddened at the news of Carrie's passing. She was a dear friend whom I greatly respected and admired. The Force is dark today. William Shatner, who of course fans will know played Captain Kirk in the Star Trek series of television and movies.
Which I was a fan of too.
Which was a big competitor for Star Wars, right. But he said, I'm deeply saddened to learn of the death of Carrie Fisher. I will miss our banterings. A wonderful talent and light has been extinguished. George Takei, who played Lieutenant Sulu on the Star Trek TV series, said, this is a heavy blow to us all. Carrie, you will always be our princess. Return to the stars now, to galaxies far, far away. Bette Midler tweeted, I'm so terribly sorry, and send my sincere condolences to her family and friends around the world. Host Ellen DeGeneres said, Carrie Fisher was a brilliant actor, writer, and friend. She was so much fun. I can't believe that she's gone. And in one of the saddest tweets that I came across today, there was actually Gary, Carrie Fisher's dog, said, saddest tweets to tweet, Mommy is gone. I love you.
Can't believe Gary had his own Twitter account, too. But
yep, he sure did.
Also, nice to see all that love coming from the Star Trek crew. Thank you so much to David Byrd. If you want to follow him on Twitter, his handle is @David_DByrd, and that's B-Y-R-D. I'm @Michael_Lippin, and this is VOA. Yeah. Here are some of the top stories right now on voanews.com. New Israeli settlement construction set for approval. Russia says U.S. policy change on arming Syrian rebels is a hostile act. Trump selects an experienced national security advisor, Tom Bossert, to serve as his assistant on counterterrorism. And a new Somali parliament takes office amid high hopes and charges of corruption. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. China has restored diplomatic relations with the tiny West African island nation of Sao Tome and Principe. A signing ceremony took place on Monday in Beijing. The impoverished former Portuguese colony announced last week that it was cutting ties with Taiwan, which it had recognized since 1997. Taiwan accused Sao Tome and Principe of demanding a huge amount of financial assistance in return for maintaining that relationship. Bruce Jacobs is a Taiwan analyst at Australia's Monash University. VOA's Victor Beattie asked him what's behind the diplomatic competition for recognition between China and Taiwan.
Because China is unwilling to have countries recognize both it and Taiwan, and this dates back to the period when both Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong insisted on a one-China policy, there's a situation now where countries officially only recognize one or the other. Taiwan's relations, official relations, have been with a diminishing number of small countries. It's now 21. The point is, this doesn't really represent Taiwan's foreign relations. Taiwan's critical foreign relations are officially unofficial. So the United States has the American Institute in Taiwan, and Taiwan has offices in the United States. And the same applies to Japan. And in fact, it was Japan that set up this model in 1972. And the same applies to Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, all the European countries. And what these countries actually have are one China, one Taiwan policies, even though they won't admit it or say it publicly. Now, what the Trump call might have done is broken down the sort of old ways of thinking and allowed people to think in new terms. And in that sense, I think it could be very good for Taiwan because it would involve a restructuring of the way people think about Taiwan.
Taiwan's Foreign Minister David Lee said that Sao Tome demanded an astronomical amount of financial assistance to continue its relations with Taipei, which it refused. Is this all about dollar diplomacy?
Before President Ma Ying-jeou came in 2008, there was a lot of dollar diplomacy between China and Taiwan to try to get official diplomatic relations. China implemented what was called a diplomatic truce. It was a tacit agreement. There were people who ran for office in various countries that recognized Taiwan who said, if I win the election, I'll recognize China. But then after they were elected, they didn't. So it seemed that China discouraged them. But now China, because President Tsai has come in, they've decided to put some pressure on. But I don't think it actually is creating any pressure. So I think that this policy of China's is sort of misguided. It's based on old ways of thinking. And I'm not quite sure how the Trump administration will work things out, but I think the fact that President Trump and President Tsai had a chat was a good sign. And I think it sets up a situation where the world can move to looking at Taiwan with sort of new glasses and clearer glasses so that it can have its proper role in the world, which is a middle-ranking power.
And that was Bruce Jacobs of Monash University speaking with International Edition's Victor Beattie. Russia's defense ministry says search teams have found the main flight data recorder from a military passenger plane that crashed in the Black Sea on Sunday. All 92 people on board were killed. Among the victims were 68 members of the Alexandrov Ensemble, a Russian military troop that was due to give a New Year's performance for Russian personnel based near the Syrian city of Latakia. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke to VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf about the investigation.
Well, we don't know a whole lot in terms of what caused the crash. There are a few different working theories that are going around. One possibility of the plane possibly having been overloaded. Another possibility that there might have been something wrong with the fuel quality. There's also a theory that something might have gotten into the engine or flown into the engine, causing the plane to go down, to lose control. The only thing we do know from authorities is that they were very quick to dismiss the possibility of terrorism. That was something that came out fairly early on before the investigation had really been underway. So that was something that they wanted to do to try and reassure the public very quickly. And also because it's a military plane, if there would be an attack, a terrorist attack on a military plane, of course, the implications of security breaches and so forth would be huge. So they came out very quickly saying that that was not a possibility as far as most of the authorities are concerned, that they're not pursuing that as a possible cause. At the same time, though, we've seen some other officials saying that, you know, they're not going to make a final conclusion until they've completed the investigation. And of course, today they did recover the first of three black box recorders, the flight data recorder, which is the main one. And that has arrived in Moscow today, and they're going to be cleaning it up and trying to get as much information as they can out of it. According to officials and Russian media reports today, they say that they may be able to get some information as soon as Friday of this week, but that it could take several weeks to get all of the information out of the black box recorder and to fully determine what may have been the cause of this crash.
What has been the reaction in Russia to this, particularly occurring at this time of year?
Well, of course, there's been a huge outpouring of grief and also support for the loss of the 92 people on board this plane. It included not only some military personnel, but over 60 members of this military ensemble of choir, orchestra, dancers. So it was a very big loss for people who were, you know, supporters and fans of these performers. They were not soldiers, of course, in the sense of being out on the battlefield, but they were members of this military ensemble that was quite well known. Also on board was Elizaveta Blinka, who's commonly known as Dr. Liza, a very well-known humanitarian aid worker who had dedicated her life to helping out the less fortunate here in Russia and also in eastern Ukraine. And so that was certainly something that was very shocking for the communities of humanitarian rights workers and aid workers here in Russia.
Well, now, the timing of this plane crash, this occurs very close to the assassination of Russia's ambassador in Turkey. Is there a concern about that?
Of course, when the military plane first went down, there was a lot of speculation and, of course, concern that this could have been something related to terrorism. And although it has not been completely and officially ruled out, of course, as you know, we were talking about earlier, the Russian officials were quick to try and dismiss it. At least some prominent Russian officials were quick to dismiss the possibility of terrorism. But it did raise a lot of eyebrows when this military plane went down so soon after this assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey, because the assassin, of course, was relating his actions, his killing the ambassador, to Russia's intervention militarily in Aleppo in Syria. And this military plane was flying from Sochi to Syria, to Russia's military base in Syria, to this band was going there to perform, and Dr. Liza was going there to bring medical supplies that she was donating to a hospital in Syria. So certainly there is a connection to Syria, and that did raise a lot of concerns that there may have been a motive for an attack on this plane.
That was VOA's Daniel Scharf speaking to International Edition's Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new preliminary study from the American Heart Association suggests that women with a history of migraines may also have an increased risk of stroke. Researchers in Florida studied over 900 women who, at the time, were being assessed for heart disease. Of the women studied, 224, or about 25% of them, reported a history of migraine headaches. The study suggests that compared to the women who did not report any migraines, those who did were found to have an 83% higher risk of some kind of cardiovascular event, such as either a stroke or heart attack, within an average 6-year follow-up. Compared to those who didn't have migraines, women with a history of migraine were also found to be a little more than twice as likely to suffer a stroke during the study. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. A growing number of robot truckers in America could begin to take jobs from the 3 million humans who drive trucks in the U.S. As VOA's Jim Randall reports, those people face a challenge in learning the new skills needed to thrive in a fast-evolving economy.
Autonomous trucks already operate in mines, while robotic cars run races up mountains. A former official of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Chen Liu, says the era of robot drivers may be here sooner than many experts expected.
We're not that far from that ultimate vision of a completely self-driving car.
Millions of Americans drive trucks. Researchers say these jobs may be at growing risk because robots are likely to be less expensive and safer than human drivers. Most wrecks are blamed on human error. Improving automation helped manufacturers produce goods with fewer people. Robots don't join unions, demand overtime pay, or show up with a hangover. That's why Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen expects companies will continue to hire fewer humans and more robots.
Most economists and policymakers recognize that it's important to provide ways for workers who are harmed by these kinds of developments to be retrained for jobs so that they can succeed in the economy.
Surprisingly, at a time when lost jobs are a major economic and political issue, many high-paying technical positions go unfilled. Economist Ken Simonson of the Associated General Contractors of America says companies can't find plumbers, electricians, pipe fitters, and others.
We are going to continue to see a lot of industries struggling to find already qualified workers or to bring the new entrants up to the skill level that they need to get things done.
Apprentices are learning key technical skills at Newport News Shipbuilding, which has a strong record of training successful workers. But researcher David Wixer of the Federal Reserve says other programs have mixed results.
Anytime you take somebody from one occupation to the other, the level of risk associated with that just magnifies incredibly. It's much safer to switch from one employer to the other to do the same thing that you've been doing.
In a TED Talk, MIT economist David Autor says American workers made a big shift from agriculture to manufacturing in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
We have faced equally momentous economic transformations in the past, and we have come through them successfully.
Workers in this latest economic transition may be in for a bumpy ride because scholars say previous major changes were wrenching and took many years. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
And that's a wrap of International Edition. My thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Nelson Lopez. I'm Michael Lippin. If you want to find me on Twitter, my handle is @Michael_Lippin. Would love to hear from you. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States values freedom of the press as a key component of democratic governance. Unfortunately, in too many places, the press has become a target of retaliation by those who feel threatened by freedom of expression and transparency in democratic processes. In its annual census of journalists imprisoned worldwide, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, found that more journalists are jailed around the world today than at any time since the CPJ began keeping detailed records in 1990. As of December 1, 2016, 259 journalists were jailed this year, compared to the 199 behind bars worldwide in 2015. Turkey accounts for nearly a third of the global total. Amid an ongoing crackdown that accelerated after a failed coup attempt in July, Turkey jailed at least 81 journalists, accusing them of anti-state activity. In addition, more than 100 news outlets have been silenced. The jailing of journalists continues to be a global problem, with China, Egypt, Eritrea, and Ethiopia as some of the other worst offenders. This year marks the first time since 2008 that Iran was not among the top five worst jailers, as many of those sentenced in the 2009 post-election crackdown have served their sentences and been released. However, Tehran is still stifling press freedom by sending journalists to jail, including filmmaker Kayvan Karimi, who is serving a sentence of 1 year in prison and 223 lashes in relation to his documentary about political graffiti, Writing in the City. The press is too often a target of retaliation by governments that repress freedom of expression and transparency. The United States will continue to speak out for the protection of journalists and for their vital role in open societies and defending the truth.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.